Hey Edward, how are you
Hi,
doing?
good. How are you?
Good. Welcome in Europe, by the way.
Yeah,
Though
it's cold
you
here.
crossed the Atlantic Ocean again.
Yeah, across the Atlantic Ocean, and it was cloudy and cold.
Yeah,
landed
welcome to our climate.
landed in London. The airplane door goes open, and you're like, "Oh, maybe I should have taken a jacket."
Oh yeah. Yep. I went to Spain last week and I brought my jacket and like it was the other way around
Yeah, you didn't need
when I was on holiday.
it.
Didn't need it. I took it on the plane inside my backpack and I never left there. So, but yeah, until I got back. So I know your pain, but yeah, it's typical European weather for now. For the last couple of months already, it's been raining all the time, but at least today some sunshine, so a good time to talk about the DevOps tooling that we use to jump right into it. So I think it was episode 10 we discussed how to get into DevOps, like the general ideas on how to get into there, like and we discussed the topics that like a job in DevOps involves and what it entails actually. So today I wanted to jump more into detail into the actual tooling that we use for that and have used as well
Like the
to
tooling
give some.
we use, the tooling we use compared to, this is the tooling you should learn, but actually this is the tooling that we used in the past and are now using a little bit, because that maybe it differs also with what we said, that you should focus on learning these tools. We have used other tools maybe we don't recommend learning anymore because it's legacy tooling, or we can like explain a little bit, this is the reason we pick this tooling and not this other tooling.
Absolutely. And some of them have become like obsolete is a big word, but yeah, in like better alternatives and like the projects that we do don't really are like ideally like you can't use them anymore for like the project that we do. But nevertheless, there are still use cases. On-prem, for example, is a very big use case. So let's dig into it. Like maybe you can start with where it all began, right? Like provisioning of things. So in the past, when we had like long-lived machines, there was like a way of like doing everything by hand, and like the first things when we, at least let me speak for myself, and I got into DevOps, the first things that was happening there was like we just need some, instead of like a big Word document on like procedure and steps on how to do it, let's build it in actual code, so that we, once we have a template, we can just run it on separate machines, and then we kind of have that, not immutability, but at least the like the configuration changes are the same across the board normally.
We
So
would package it. Like back in the day, we would package it. Like we would have an RPM package for Red Hat-based systems and a Debian package for Debian-based systems. And that could actually include some configuration that needed to be done to get an application running. Or we would push configuration binaries and scripts packaged as a Debian or RPMs to machines to maintain them, or kind of to install the tooling on. That I remember that doing that at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. What I was more referring to was like tools like Ansible, Chef, Puppet, stuff like that.
Yeah, I think like the RPMs and Debians was like just before that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like that's where actually the configuration would go before Ansible and Puppet and Chef, because then you would be like, well, it's difficult to package like your application every time you need to make a configuration change, because the configuration lives a little bit outside your application that you're running, or maybe you're running multiple applications. And then indeed we kind of started with CellStack is another one, Ansible, Chef, to kind of get your machines to a state that you trust. That was like the first configuration as code that I think you and also me came in contact with.
Absolutely. And for quite some time, like there were back then there was a lot of like competition between the tools like Puppet and Chef and SaltStack and Ansible
Yeah,
and Bud.
I remember you had the pull mechanism, like Chef was
Yeah,
like,
the
we had a
push.
server, and then a lot of people were like, yeah, no, this is the way to go. You need to have a server to check your compliance, and then you can kind of see when there's a configuration drift. Or you had Ansible, and it was like push over SSH, and then people were like, yeah, but you have to type in Ansible and do the SSH connection to know whether there is a drift. But then you had Control Tower, but that was a paid version, I think, because Red Hat then bought
Yeah,
Ansible, and you had to kind
I
of
think
pay.
I can't remember that I actually used Control Tower. But the way I used Ansible was in most cases it was kind of like it was already on the end. It was already I was already working on cloud, so it was Ansible in combination with Packer mainly. To kind of make pre-baked AMIs that then like pull in configuration and then according to the environments would spin up and then run the application. So you had an artifact and immutable infrastructure, but that's a bit ahead of our schedule here. So.
Yeah, I think
So.
what was big back in the day, I remember when I was using Ansible and Chef, we were using a lot of HashiCorp tooling, Vagrant, spin up VMs, before there was Docker. Then in DTS at Packer, so to create VMs, to create images, you would use Packer, which you can still use today if you need to build an AMI on or an image
Absolutely.
on any of the cloud providers. That's what you would still use. Then there was also other tooling in HashiCorp that was popular at the time. They also had an orchestrator. They had console. They had lots of like these small tools that you would need. Like once you were in the HashiCorp ecosystem, you would kind of try out more of that tooling. I think I'm talking about like 2013, 2014, that well, yeah, 10 years ago, that the tooling was really interesting. Like what HashiCorp was bringing out was really interesting. You had like this key value store that you would use for configuration, for example, like a console cluster. I'm sure that you also used it. That's where
Yeah,
you took your
absolutely, absolutely.
configuration. You had Vault, right? Vault. And that kind of predates, I think, like the secret and parameter store in cloud providers. They were kind of the first one to bring out this tooling, cloud agnostic. You would run it on-prem, maybe even on the cloud provider when it was not released as a feature yet. And then we stopped all using this tooling because then you had all these features in a cloud provider. So then we migrated everything to the native cloud software. I mean, not cloud native, but the kind of the products that the
Absolutely.
cloud providers came out with.
Which totally makes sense because like it became such an important part of your application stack that it's hard to like if that would break, there weren't any machines that could spin up and get configuration. So your complete stack would be down if the console cluster had some issues. And that was like while when Amazon came out with Parameter Store and the Secret Manager, for example, that was like oh, okay, they manage it now. It's like it's okay. Like we don't need to do that anymore. Like that's a
Then you also have an issue with Vault, like this vaulting. You set it up, and you had like to enter three keys or something,
yeah.
and
And if it
then
reboots.
these reboots, and then everything is down, and then someone you need to then find the people with the keys. You enter
Yeah,
the
exactly
keys
that.
to get the application back running. I mean, it is like, yes, this should be the way, but no, this is just not practical.
No, it's not, no, exactly. Then the implementation of AWS and other cloud providers is a bit like easier to do. And also like it's encrypted and everything, but yeah, I still remember some outages because of that. And like when you're doing releases with AMIs and the AMI is baked and it's not very fast, but then eventually the AMI starts starting and then all of a sudden like it's not running and then you have to debug something completely unrelated to the application stack. It's it's a pain in the ass. I'm happy we got rid of that actually back then, but it was a good use case, like totally makes sense. But yeah, in the end, I'm very happy that we got rid of that. Obviously what we also were using, and we're still valid use case for that as well, like for the CI, Jenkins was a very big thing as well, but it was the same thing. It became so important in the stack that the Jenkins server, like nothing was able to being able to build or to release. All your automations would be in there, even like whatever vacuums of the Postgres database, stuff like that, you would use it. At least I would do it. Maybe that was not a good use case, but you would use it at a cron, like a managed cron, right? Like I have this task I have to run, just SSH into it and do it, like whatever. But it became so important, like it was not highly available setup. It was just like, that's a Jenkins server. Also, it became so important, so you don't want to touch it that often. So you don't upgrade it that often.
At some point, you kind of I remember like cleaning these workspaces in Jenkins, like too many workspaces. Oh, you're running out of disk space. You cannot. I was expanding those days, and then
all those job histories.
do we still need like the workspace from 5 years ago of an app that we don't use? And
yeah, and then Bitbucket came out with Bitbucket pipelines, I think it was. I think it was before GitHub. It wasn't. Yeah, I think it was Bitbucket pipelines that was the first one, right?
Bitbucket pipelines was the first one. Actually, no. You also had this other product, CircleCI. Is it CircleCI?
Oh yeah.
So we actually already did some migrations from Jenkins to CircleCI, but CircleCI is quite expensive. And then people were often integrated with Bitbucket. I think Bitbucket was also a bit more popular in back in that day. And
you know, the integration with Confluence and all that other tooling.
And
Jira. It makes sense, right? Jira, yeah.
And then when Bitbucket pipelines came out, it's like, oh, this is like a no-brainer. You just commit this one file, Bitbucket pipelines.yaml or something like that. And then we kind of started moving over our Jenkins. Within Jenkins, there was still a kind of a migration as well, because first you would declare all your configuration within Jenkins, and then you would have the Jenkins file, and then you would write everything in the Jenkins file, so you have everything in your Git repository.
Yeah.
So you would go from project properties to Jenkins file, and you were like, oh, Jenkins file, now we can migrate to those Bitbucket pipelines. Well, the big downside in the beginning of the Bitbucket pipelines was just that you only had like 2 gigs of memory or something, or 4 gigs of memory, which was quickly exhausted for the bigger projects. And then like there was no option. And then one day we got an email, I remember, oh, we can just like add like one flag in the YAML file, worker 2x or something, you know? And then you just get double the amount of memory. It's like, you still couldn't choose to have a lot of memory. No, just 2x. And then it's like, oh, now we can migrate these jobs that were still on the Jenkins, where we are still running this Jenkins server. Now we can migrate them to Bitbucket pipelines.
It worked quite well.
Yeah, but then, like with a lot of products, it's like great in the beginning, but then they kind of say, oh, it has the features that we want, or we don't really have a team available to build more features. And then like it got stale very quickly, you know? Like, it's like you want more features, they're not there. And then GitHub Actions came out. And once GitHub Actions came out, it's like, okay. And there was actually something else. There was another product. Like GitHub was integrating with another product before GitHub Actions. I don't know the name.
Travis.
Travis. So I actually done GitHub with Travis was another alternative. Once GitHub Actions came out, it's like, okay, yeah. Clearly, so much more features than Bitbucket pipelines. And also with Bitbucket pipelines, you couldn't run your own workers. So that was also a big issue. With Circle, you could run your own workers pretty early. And that was often how we were doing it with the bigger workloads. So nowadays, I think a lot is on GitHub Actions. So Bitbucket pipelines is not used that much anymore. It is also because lacking feature parity with the bigger ones.
Yeah,
And then
it looked like
GitLab.
they're wrapped up, like
Yeah.
this is finished.
Yeah.
This is
No,
it. Yeah.
I saw there were more features coming out, but it just took a few
Yeah, but
years to
not
start.
in the velocity of like
Yeah, no.
GitHub, for example, or something
Yeah,
like
but
that.
then
It's like,
GitHub was then bought by Microsoft, and then they got the kind
yeah,
of
true.
the right, not the right people, but more people on it, and now it's easier to release. And then he also had GitLab, but we were not really big users of GitLab, I think. It was more like corporate software. I mean, it was used in a lot
Absolutely.
of corporate enterprises, because Bitbucket and actually you're forgetting one. Don't you remember Bamboo? We're actually using Bamboo because
Oh
Bamboo
yeah,
was like the
exactly.
before Bitbucket Pipelines, it was Bamboo, and that was
Yeah,
with actually what you would run.
Bamboo.
That
Yeah,
was
I
the
never used. I used it, but not that
on-prem.
much.
You used it
Like,
on-prem at some points. Yeah.
yeah, true, true.
So yeah, then so Bamboo goes to Bitbucket, then you have GitHub Actions, and then you also have GitLab. GitLab was more used on-prem, but then you had then the cloud version. Like actually, it was built to be on-prem, and then they came out with the cloud version. Then people started using cloud version because it was also a pain to kind of maintain, needed a massive server and so on.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now I think today, if you had to make a decision, well, GitHub is quite a no-brainer, but you also have GitLab now that you could that you that has a lot of features. Bitbucket, yeah, if you're already in the
Well,
Atlassian
still, yeah.
ecosystem.
For like, depending if the features are sufficient for you, right? Like,
I think the companies that are already in Bitbucket, they are using Bitbucket for Git, they're using Jira, they use Bitbucket pipelines. Companies that are in GitHub, they just use GitHub Actions. I think that's a different. Jenkins, I think everyone wants to get rid of Jenkins. I don't think it's used that
Yeah.
much anymore.
The thing is, like, it's
Still,
just a,
it's still used a
it's
lot.
still used a
Yeah,
lot.
it's still used a
It's
lot. But people want to get rid
but
of it.
yeah, but it's just so easy to get it running, and then you have all your crons in one place and all that stuff. But like, when you just have to imagine that you couldn't get it up again anymore, and then everything is down, and then just thinking about that, like, such a peace of mind when it's like it's just a YAML file or whatever somewhere, and it just basically does everything automatically. It's just such a peace of mind, because it would break down like out of memory or out of workspace space, whatever, like on the most inconvenient ways or and moments. So yeah, definitely. That's a good comparison. GitHub, Bitbucket. Yeah, I would definitely go for those right now. And then afterwards we kind of went to more the container route, I think already. That was also cool. Then you could build your containers not locally anymore and push them, but also in the CI,
Yeah, it took some
depending
time,
on
I
worker.
remember.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, because there was no Docker support in the beginning of Bitbucket pipelines, I think. It was just to create art jars or artifacts or whatever, and that was basically it. And then you have to build it yourself and then push it. And that was the benefit of using Jenkins still, because you could do like on the Jenkins server, build the asset, next step, build a Docker container from that. Yeah. So that was a good times, but
Also use
luckily,
Artifactory to store your artifacts,
Oh, it cost money,
and
as
then
crazy, but yeah.
yeah, and then you would still push all the assets there because you wouldn't store them on Jenkins, and then you would still like if you built RPM or Debian package, you would then have Artifactory as a repository, and then push them to your servers.
To serve it.
Yeah, so
Yep,
that would also,
absolutely.
yeah, Artifactory is not used that much anymore because indeed you just push everything using Docker containers now. So I think
Yeah.
there's a little bit of history.
That's kind of the artifact, right? Like,
Docker container, Docker image is actually now the artifact. Yeah.
like everything is contained into one. So that was pretty cool to see the transition from like long-lived AMI, long-lived machines, to like configuration as code, to AMIs, and then the next step, then the containers. That was a cool evolution to see.
There wasn't Kubernetes yet, so at that point you would just run the container using Docker Compose or something. You spin up a machine, Docker app or something, Docker Compose app, and that will bring up your containers. Then there was Swarm before there was Kubernetes, so you could use something like Swarm. But then there were issues with networking and all these kind of things, so that was all.
My first use case was locally for Docker actually, because we had this huge stack in Vagrant, and then Vagrant up, and then your laptop would almost take off. it would start all the application to be able to locally develop, but then I basically transformed that into Docker containers with. Yeah, like a high success rate, but nevertheless, it wasn't that simple. It was like a lot of components, microservices all over the place that then had to run. It was like a big Docker compose file, but that worked pretty well. I was like, it was cool to see then the transition from being used as a local tool more to actually be able to run it on servers without like Docker compose and stuff like that, because it was still. Yeah, a bit wonky.
Yeah, the org saves came like Kubernetes and then also ECS on Amazon, and then once they were there you would actually run them indeed on the servers, not just locally. And then they also kind of
Also still in an AMI actually, to be honest.
yeah,
Like
because the networking was not fixed in the beginning, right? I remember,
Yep.
like, okay, you need to do you need to run a container on a specific port that is not being used by another container.
Yep, exactly.
And then have a load balancer that knows a port or something, or that gets notified about a port, I don't remember. And it will then route the traffic. But it would work. It would just not be super convenient.
Did you actually use Docker Swarm at some point? Or, okay, yeah.
Before Kubernetes, Docker Swarm. Like it kind of just worked.
Cool.
But and I think it's even today, it just kind of just works. It just Kubernetes became the hype, so now it's all
True.
Kubernetes, I think. And then it's just
Yep,
because it's
true.
more flexible. And then yeah, the sad part is that kind of Docker, the company behind Docker, missed the boat kind of because of nobody cared suddenly about Docker itself anymore. Like you wouldn't
No.
run it, they wouldn't have a way to monetize easily, and then everything went to Kubernetes, which is just Google, which is also a bit of a sad story.
Yeah, they failed to monetize it, which kind of accelerated also, I think, the adoption of it if they would monetize it in the beginning. But yeah, nevertheless, like it.
Yeah, because like Docker was also just a layer over this LXC, or what's it called, that came out in the kernel earlier, that allowed for better isolation between processes and C groups, and like combination of a few things that
I think the wasn't the operating system I think Solaris like from back in the day they I think they used it to separate their workspaces
that already existed for a very long time.
but it was really old already like
I think it was called jail or something, and then you could kind of separate a process,
yeah
and
it
it was
was
built in the kernel. There was also some free BSD systems that had some kind of jails. There was also chroot, but chroot, the thing was you could kind of escape chroot if you, I mean, it was just kind of allow you to only see a part, like one directory, but it was not really isolation on the kernel level. And then other features that came later in the kernel allowed you then to kind of really do the isolation properly, so that you had like a slash proc directory that you will only see your own stuff and stuff like that, that you wouldn't see all the processes that you couldn't attach to other processes. So the isolation part was really missing. But I think indeed in the Unix there are also alternatives, and there was also definitely isolation.
It was called Solaris Zones, by the way. I found it. Zones, yeah.
In FreeBSD or something, it's
Yeah.
called jail or something. But jail could be similar to
It
chroot.
was kind of the same thing. But we used it at the bank I used to work at. That's why, yeah, I had yeah, sentimental value. I had to look it up. So.
Some things already just exist, but like you had to pay for it. It was not very popular. And now once you had it in the Linux kernel, it's a little bit like WireGuard. Once it came in the Linux kernel, I see like now everyone can have a VPN on their home appliance that runs a recent Linux kernel.
Yeah, exactly. And super lightweight.
And that was not possible in the past, you know, because these things, they are like completely like embedded systems. There's no tooling on there. But yeah, like if it has a Linux kernel, it can still run something like WireGuard on it because it's baked in the Linux kernel. So that's quite interesting.
Yeah, and it's not that memory intensive like OpenVPN or other VPN providers. So, yeah, it definitely makes sense to be able to use that on such a small machine as
Yeah, we
well.
kind of missed it as well, but when we were setting up all these things, we also needed a VPN. So we would use like something like OpenVPN. And also we would also have to do the user management in Jenkins and in other toolings. And then we would also use something like OneLogin that we even use today. So I think from tooling, like from companies that we are still using today, OneLogin is actually a big one, I think. Like OneLogin is something that we used 10, 12, 13 years ago, and still today.
It was just feature rich for the price point.
Yes, I
And
mean,
still is actually.
yeah. Like Okta is quite expensive. I mean, I didn't check recently, but when we were comparing, it was quite expensive for what we needed it. And OneLogin was really
Yeah, it
nice
was
for
like
smaller
triple or
companies.
something like that.
Triple, yeah.
Yeah.
OneLogin is really nice for small companies. So we would use something like OneLogin, SAML, and then kind of connect everything with OneLogin using SAML. And like and that's something we still do today. So I find it actually interesting to mention as well that for identity provider, I mean OneLogin and alternatives, this is still something that you need. This never goes away. I think you
No,
always have
no.
employees, users that you somehow need to manage. And then you want that if you offboard an employee that he doesn't
Hopefully.
have access anymore to any of your systems. So
Yep. And like the beginning, you don't need it until you have to do it a couple of times, and then you know this is such a hassle, and you forget stuff, and you come across users when you log in into the user page, and they're like, "Huh, this person is already left for quite some time." At in a previous that issue in a previous company that yeah, like access points to everything was like so dispersed everywhere that it didn't make much sense. So and it was like looking around for tools that you didn't know, even knew that existed. So it's definitely something to look at as well, like and especially at that price point, it's just easy that everything integrates with one thing, just easy peasy, and then you can go from there and integrate it further with all your cloud providers, VPN software, all that stuff. Totally makes sense. Like, yeah, the containers, obviously, then we started using, like, yeah, I was already using cloud, so AWS, Azure, GCP.
infrastructure, what was it called? Just, you know, compute as a service kind
Yeah.
of.
I still remember that those stickers on the back of people's computer, like cloud is just somebody else's computer. You remember those? Like, it's
That
like,
was how
yeah,
it was in the
that's
beginning.
exactly.
But
It's no
then,
longer the case for quite some time already, right?
so
Like,
I think we went kind of from, okay, you need to commit for a year or 2 years or 3 years to actually buy a server, rent a server, to okay, you only have to commit to a minute. And that was when cloud was invented. Okay, you don't need to do the CapEx and all this kind of stuff. But then they started building on that you actually also have other products, like
absolutely.
1,000 products today or thousands of products today. But back in the day, it was just like compute. So you would just run this EC2 instance in a shared network. There wouldn't even be a
Exactly.
network. Like VPC didn't exist in the beginning. You would just like get an internal IP address, and if you then opened if you start a server on that private IP address, then within the AWS network, another EC2 could then reach your server. So if you didn't properly password protect it, then within the internal network, people could still kind of log into your services. So
Oh yeah.
yeah, that was interesting. EC2 Classic. EC2 Classic.
Luckily they discontinued that.
And then I think
Yeah.
we just used, yeah, we like you just used the wizard in the beginning to
Yeah.
launch an instance, then the API, Python, just with the like Boto or Boto 3 or something. And then indeed they had Packer, was written in Ruby, I guess. Everything, a lot of things were written in Ruby from HashiCorp.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then only then there was Terraform, right? Which is also from HashiCorp. right? So there's actually a lot of tooling from HashiCorp.
Yeah, the infrastructure as code, that was an interesting one as well.
Yeah.
To get started with that, like you said, you go through the wizard every time and then, I forgot, wrong region, wrong subnet, wrong whatever.
Now you can change like the IAM role and these kind of things. But back in the day, you couldn't. So you had to relaunch the instance every time you made a mistake. Like now you can change things. You can stop the instance and make a change, or you can just change it while the instance is running. But back in the day, it was not possible. So every time you want to make a change, you had to terminate the instance or something like that. Yeah.
Luckily, that's no longer the case.
But the first provisioning was happening with tooling like Ansible, I remember. It was only then later when we switched to Terraform. And Terraform is so popular, people are using it still today like crazy.
It's easy to get started with it as well. Like you have a good training about it, but also it's easy to find code snippets and stuff like that to get you started, to get you off the ground running. So you don't like, and it's also self-explanatory, like unless you start doing weird functions sometimes. But nevertheless, it's still a very good tool.
Yeah, and I think at that point, so then we start using Terraform. And then we also realized that Terraform is actually not the best tool to deploy the application. So it's good to describe the infrastructure. But to deploy the application itself would be a bit more difficult. So in the beginning, you could indeed create auto-scaling groups, bake the AMI and change the AMI with Packer. But then there was containers and there was no Kubernetes on Amazon. There was ECS, but ECS was missing a lot of features. So then we actually came out with ECS Deploy, which was our own internal tooling to do kind of provisioning, scaling.
Log management, like to view the logs, actually.
And also to, it would kind of connect with the Git repositories somehow. The Git repositories would actually do API calls to ECS deploy to say, I have this new service, and it would provision a new ECS service task, do all the load balancer stuff, target group, because that all didn't exist. Now you could do all this while you actually use app, this app run, or what's it called, AWS app runner, or you have like these pipelines, code pipeline, code build, code deploy, ECS code deploy. But in the beginning, it wasn't there. I mean,
no. You had to do it yourself.
Then a lot of stuff was not there yet. So then, I mean, ECS deploy, it's not really necessary anymore today, I would say. You could do the same with code deploy in a GitHub action. And with Terraform, yeah, a lot of people use similar things now with Terraform modules to build the architecture that you need, and then just kind of push your application code using GitHub Actions and then code deploy. Like there's code deploy GitHub Action even, I think, that you could use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to take it over. Oh, true. Absolutely. And then, you can also check out our I think, isn't ECS Deploy, is that publicly available?
Yeah. So github.com/infrared, that's where you find all our tooling, ECS Deploy.
We try to give back of things that we like use a lot.
Yeah, it's just, I wouldn't run it maybe today anymore. I mean, maybe a specific. I mean, there's still customers who are running it, so like, it definitely makes sense in certain situations.
Absolutely, it just abstracts also a lot of the AWS toolings still today. So that's for some people that's very useful.
We also have an advanced proxy there on our GitHub page, which is also used today still. RocksProx, so the RocksProx repository. So if you need like an advanced gateway, and the API gateway of AWS is not good enough because you need more features, but you think Glue and Kong and all these other ones are too expensive, then there's an alternative right there.
Yeah, it works quite well.
And it works quite well indeed in production already for years without issues. And just use Envoy, right? So you never pass. The data never passes our code. Our code is just managing config. It just uses Envoy, probably kind of provisions the config of Envoy. So everything passes Envoy, which is like super efficient advanced proxy.
Yeah, definitely.
AWS came out with all these products, Azure came out, Google Cloud came out with Kubernetes, and then suddenly you have all these products that you can use with Terraform. So I think the tooling that we often use is like just Terraform. Terraform with all these cloud providers. And all these cloud providers actually also have templates to provision. So we also use CloudFormation. I think the first time we came into contact with CloudFormation was really through Elastic Beanstalk.
Yeah.
Which you don't want to use anymore, these legacy services.
Why is this taking so long?
And it's like, oh, wait, there's a CloudFormation template that it uses, and that's why it takes so long. Sometimes it breaks. Yeah. And, yeah. Maybe it doesn't break today.
Everything changes. I don't use it.
No, we migrate.
We've been across it for quite some time.
We migrate all our customers away.
Yeah, exactly. But nevertheless, even with new customers, like it was, I don't come across it anymore.
Indeed, that's funny. Yeah. Well, some of the old installs, I think we have one customer that still has some old installs on Elastic Beanstalk, for example. Like if you provisioned 10 years ago and you didn't touch it in the meantime, most likely it is, there's a chance it runs on Elastic Beanstalk.
No, true. But nevertheless, I don't see anybody else still using it.
Yeah, you just don't see it. It's like you think Jenkins is not used anymore and you go into corporate X and then it's like, you're using 1,000 Jenkins instances.
Yep, exactly. Well, which makes sense.
It's always like this tooling that nobody uses anymore, and then you go into an enterprise and you say, we are big users of this. We are big users of this.
Which makes sense because they are able to support it. The most of our guidelines exactly are, if it's not your core task, just. And you can pay somebody $5 for it to do it. Let the company do that for you instead of like trying to do that yourself. Another big thing that we use and used is monitoring and observability. Because ECS deploy kind of touched kind of some, like there's a health check and you can view your log files and stuff like that. But another important thing that we used also a lot back in the day was like once you have a couple of instances running, it becomes really hard really quick to what is going on. It's CPU of server XYZ that is running is burning hot or whatever. And then in the beginning, I think. At least I started with Nagios, I think it was called, back in the day.
MRTG.
No, I started with Nagios. That was the first.
Those were graphing, like network graphs, MRTG, very recently. And then you had Cacti or something.
Exactly.
And then Nagios.
I used.
Didn't we see that guy? Either. Like, weren't you with me when we were at Fosdam in Belgium? And there was a talk about the guy that wrote, is Nagios or Nagios? Nagios, I don't know. This is like some sales guy, a salesy guy. No, you were not there? Oh, no. Yeah.
Possibly I was, but...
That's already a very long time ago. And he did a presentation. He was like very, very vocal, very like, you would think it was some kind of nerd that wrote it, but he was like, I think he was in a completely different industry and he kind of,
like weekend project,
yeah, something like that. Like that was a super interesting story. I think it was the same. It was like the same year. I think that there was a Riser explaining Riser FS.
I
think then he went to jail or something. Now,
yeah, exactly.
And then they removed it from the Linux kernel because then people were actually running Riser FS, and I remember like, we should get maybe rid of Riser FS because it's not going to be supported anymore.
No, the guy was, I don't know, was arrested. His wife disappeared or something like that. And then his car seat was out of his car as well. Something like that was something really weird. But different. It's not a crime podcast here.
There are other podcasts.
Probably somebody covered it already. And I don't want to make any assumptions of stuff that I'm not sure about. But yeah, I think Nagios was but that was more for metrics, and then your logs will still be over the place. And then I think it was next step was like log aggregation. For me, at least, the Elk stack.
And then you had like these plugins. Wait, because everything came into Elasticsearch, JSON.
Logstash, or...
Yeah, Logstash was sent into Elasticsearch.
Yeah.
But then in Elasticsearch, you also had this frontend, which I forgot the name of.
Kibana,
yes, Kibana. But then if you want to nicely see the logs, then you need like some kind of log plugin in Kibana.
Yeah.
And then, like, there are a lot of steps involved to actually get a nice log. And then one system would log in just a different way, and it would kind of screw up everything.
Everything would be screwed, yeah.
And then you had to clear the indices in Elasticsearch, and then you had to put cron tabs, because otherwise they would go on forever.
And the machine would grow.
You had to do a cron tab with a curl to delete the index. First you would close it or something, and then... Yeah, that was all management and maintaining.
Indices are like yellow and stuff like that, and good stuff. No,
yeah, well, you had brain split. Was that split brain?
Yeah.
Your network split would brain, go apart, and then
two clusters that
they couldn't merge.
No quorum.
But we had it with some systems. I remember that you had some systems like that. Like, you cannot merge because. Not as writes on both somehow, you know, something is not supposed to happen or something like that. Yeah,
good times.
Now you wonder why people are giving so much money to Datadog, but when you think back to how it was, then it's like,
yeah, exactly. We already discussed that in previous episodes, like, why are people spending so much money in Datadog? But like, yeah, now we have gone the memory lane of this stuff. I'm like, yeah. Totally worth it.
Money, just like, I don't want to deal with this stuff anymore.
And also, like, because it's not critical per se, like, it's running somewhere and then something goes wrong and then you opened it and then it was broken. So, like, that's it's like, okay, now I have to monitor the monitoring. But, like, it's that stuff. Yeah, now I was very happy to get rid of that. I move it to something managed. You're like New Relic, Datadog. I'm still used a lot today as well, mainly because it's managed, I guess. And then with the arrival of, I think it was it with the arrival of Kubernetes, like Prometheus, it was kind of the same time, right? Or am I?
Yeah, it probably existed earlier, but for us, it was like, okay, I think Kubernetes also made some other tooling. Or give more traction, like Prometheus was one of them. There's more open telemetry that you also have now, which is now called open trace, I think. But you had like these toolings that you would kind of send your traces to, and then
Jaeger
and things like that. And I don't know if that's still used today. Like Amazon has X-Tray, which is nicer than it used to be, and then also
on-premise.
In Datadog, you also have APM, where you can send your traces to. So there's a lot of hosted services now, but indeed on-prem you would still use it. But my point was actually that there was kind of tracing, but there was no standard around it. And then now there's a standard, and the tooling might still be the same, but now there's just a standard of how your traces should look like. And then you use either Datadog or some on-prem tooling. And then now it kind of needs to be integrated. That's what observability actually is. Like you get a trace, but how does that trace connect to your logs? Like what's the relationship between a certain error in your log, like maybe at the same time, and then Datadog and then other systems, they try to connect all these things. And that's kind of how you can then...
Like, what was the CPU IO on that moment of that log file? Like stuff like that you can combine everything. Yeah, because that was a... If your screen full of full of windows to see, like, on this time, oh wait, this is UTC+2, this is UTC+0, this is in
I think it was pretty far from that, because you need to just run servers and some servers wouldn't have the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Like the NTP drifts on some machines, and but not only that, in different time zones, which makes it hard as well. So
Yeah, indeed, in the past it was not always the case. Maybe it was just us not using best practices, but in the past it was a big mess, these kind of things. And now it's a bit easier, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely,
But
absolutely.
also costly. You know, you were just kind of talking about it, right? Like how expensive all these SaaS services are now. Like if you are paying so much money to all these services just for any feature, is a bit of a that's a bit of a downside. Like
Yeah, exactly. And then they try to upsell you constantly, like, oh, you want logs, but do you also want to search the logs? I don't have to pay for them. Yeah, you can, like, stuff like that. I'm not a big fan of that either. It's like everybody has smelled money all of a sudden or something. I don't know.
it's probably going to be maybe a shift. I wouldn't say like for everything, but like some companies might say, okay, this is too expensive for us. This pricing is crazy. They just went too far. Like we will just start running things on the on Amazon again, or like or on Prime again, instead of using these services. I'm sure that some companies are looking into that, because so like I think Datadog is the example of how like one service provider, it can just be too expensive for what it is. It just your logs, your monitoring, your tracing, and it can be more than all your infrastructure combined somehow, you know?
The thing is, of course, like it brings a lot of value, but like that's
For the engineers, right? It doesn't bring any value for the end user. Okay, it can bring value for the end user if the app doesn't go down, but for the engineer, it's just okay, this is nice. And that's a bit tricky. That would be like in my head, that would be one of the first, if you would really have to cut costs, that would be one of the first things I would actually look into, think of it right now. Like we did this previous episode on cutting costs on AWS. Okay, you do reserved instances, you build down 20, 30%. But if you then think like, okay, how much are you spending in all these extra services like Datadog, and there's probably other service providers, can you not switch to, for example, CloudWatch, some other services that might be available, and maybe you have just a little bit of less nice interface.
And you have to open two windows, maybe.
Sort of service providers, maybe there's other products that you can use, and then you still have a nice interface. Maybe you just pay half the price. I think this is like, because so many companies are right now, like we are at Q2 2024, they are looking into saving costs, right? So
Yeah, absolutely.
do you want to keep the engineers the same, because that's what you need you to support your app? If you want cloud engineers, well, maybe you should just kind of cut costs in the fancy tooling. Maybe you
Yeah,
don't need
true,
all the
true.
fancy tooling, and then you cut some of the cost of the fancy tooling, and maybe you can keep some engineers, you know, and that might be a bit more difficult for some to do some things.
Yeah, and also you would need them, and also but the thing is like this, that those are recurring costs, right? Like if you have to change them, you have to change the tooling out. It's going to be a project. There's going to be project time involved. So it's going to cost money to get it out. So like it's a bit short-sighted to not do it. It's
Yeah,
You pay someone, you have the
exactly.
money tomorrow, right? But then you will it might degrade over time enormously. Whereas indeed you need to first spend money to, unfortunately, to migrate away
Like,
from expensive systems.
if you have to invest a couple of thousand of to get rid of the like service X, but it costs like 1,000 a month, like it's like, ah, but I don't want to make the investment now. And then you see how time flies by. Like 6 months is nothing, but you already spent 6,000 over those like last 6 months. So it's crazy that like you should definitely prioritize that and have a look into that, because it can save you a lot of money. Also,
If you look back in the last 10 years when we have been using Amazon, saying something like, we'll not make the reservation now, or we'll not reduce the cost now,
because we don't know the workload now.
it's always the case. Like, the case is always, the end result is always like, if we just did it then, we would have saved so much more money. That's always the problem. Like, you want to buy the RIs, just buy them today.
Pro tip for AWS sales: in the billing dashboard, you have the what you could save at that time, but maybe add another page like, if you had done this a year ago, you would have saved this amount of money. Something like that.
We should have a prime for AWS and then like a autosave or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Auto buy RI.
But what I did understand, like with reserved instances, when it was on like when you do it on a specific type and you're gonna migrate away from them or something like that, and but you have a savings plan for that now in AWS at least. So there's just no excuse anymore. You just reserve the baseline.
The excuse is indeed we don't know whether we're gonna keep those instance types, but you end up keeping them for a year anyways. Like this, like in 90% of the cases, 80 or 90% of the cases, you actually keep them. And then it's like, oh, are we going to migrate to ARM64? It will take a year anyway, so.
yeah, definitely. But then we're going to do it right then when we migrate it.
Either you do it this week or you buy the RIs. It should be something like that. You do it this week or you buy the RIs because, you know, 1 month becomes 2 months and suddenly it's a year.
Yeah, exactly. And also it's not that crazy of a priority in most cases as well.
But a year just goes by very quickly. I mean, if you're a startup and you don't know whether you survive, okay, makes sense, right? But if you have the money and you are sure that your company's going to be around for at least another year, well, it often makes sense just to... it's 20 to 30%, right?
Burning it.
Yeah, exactly. No, awesome.
I think we have one last thing, Our editors.
Editors, yeah.
I didn't start with VI or Vim, but I was like...
Are you a nano person?
Yeah, but I was like, in the time it still was called Pico.
Pico, exactly.
And then you had Emacs as well, like Red Hat. Yeah. When Red Hat 6 was not Red Hat Enterprise 6.
Yeah, true.
I'm thinking of what year it was. It was something like 2003. I bought myself a book about Vim. Like how do you really learn it? It must have been 2003. And then it's like, okay, you have to use the commands. But then like DD removes the line and stuff like that. And it's like, it's actually quite interesting. And then since then, like I know so many shortcuts
it's a full text editor without then using your mouse. That was like there was like the cool kids editor as well, right? Like if you could create panes and stuff like that, it was like if you know all those shortcuts, your hand didn't have to leave the keyboard.
There was still a group that would just use it and not know all the shortcuts.
Oh, no, definitely.
Yeah, because if you need a book or at least some kind of manual to learn all the shortcuts, because there's also like, okay, Y is yank a line, DD is remove the line, but you can also do like D20D or something, or you can make a macro with the @, and then you can execute a macro, but then you can execute the macro multiple times and stuff like that. I still use that stuff today. Like I learn like, 2003. Okay, I 20 years ago I learned shortcuts and I still know them and I still use them every day. It's pretty crazy.
Especially to replace text and stuff like that. It was just so easy instead of like using awk or whatever. Like it was just so easy to do it in there.
But then I wouldn't for programming. I wouldn't use it. I switched from some time ago. I mean, quite some time ago. To VS Code. It's just nice to have the integrations.
Unless it was to edit emergency.
I mean, I still use
batches Vim. On production that nobody did, of course, but
I would still use. I would only use it for programming, right? So text editing, like editing a JSON or something, I would still use it. Editing a text file, I'll still use it. But then just for the programming,
config files, absolutely.
Because it's just too much work to kind of set up. You launch VS Code, you have like this Go PLS if you're writing Golang. The highlighting, but also like you can easily open
documentation and stuff like that.
The documentation, but also the code from the libraries stuff like that. And I mean, I'm sure it's all possible in in other editors as well, but
UI.
it's just so much
Like,
easier
yeah.
for me then.
Yeah, exactly. No, same here. Like text highlighting, all that stuff in VS Code is just like so much better. And like you said, it's probably all possible, but yeah, why? This.
To be more efficient. But I feel like I am more efficient in VS Code than
Yeah, definitely.
I mean
Like, you don't need the.
I use the mouse, okay, but I also need all the integrations and be able to switch between programming languages and
If that's gonna be my unproductive restraint to use the mouse, then yeah, we've come a long way already, I think.
I'm sure yeah, I have like a plugin to have the same shortcuts in VS Code.
Yeah.
But then so that then I tried it in Eclipse one day, but that kind of didn't feel the same or something, and then I put turn it off. Yeah.
No, exactly.
I'm thinking
Maybe.
yeah, I think we went through
Yeah,
all the
go ahead.
tooling, but I'm sure we forgot something. We probably need like a second episode just to go over the tooling that we missed.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, there's one thing maybe we could mention. Since when? Since 2010, 2013, we both use MacBooks.
Yeah, definitely.
It just doesn't break.
Yeah, exactly.
You buy a new computer, a new MacBook, but the previous one is still working. It just never kind of broke. I could still use my MacBook from 2015, which is nine years old now, and it would still work. It would not be fast.
I've still a very old one on on the countertop.
Oh
It's
yeah.
crazy.
We also have a very old one somewhere. It still works.
Yeah.
The battery is not good anymore. You could change battery. There's lots of videos online.
Yeah,
There's not
but
enough memory probably in it, but you could upgrade the memory in the old ones, not in the new ones anymore. It
yeah,
just
it's
works so much
embedded.
better, like you open it, it works. And it also integrates with all the other tooling. Like you copy something, you have an iPhone, you paste something in there.
Absolutely works a lot better.
Secure by default, I wouldn't say secure by default completely, but like you can easily put on encryption and then
Yeah.
everything is locked, everything is encrypted. Like you use your Apple ID, which is also locked, so like you lose your phone, you lock your phone. Once you are in the Apple ecosystem, it's kind of like, yeah, it's a no-brainer. And then what amazes me then is that companies don't other companies when you see other companies, they don't have this integrated system. That is completely crazy. Like the how slow people are because of bad hardware in some companies is completely crazy. Like if you see how efficient we are.
Even still today, like I can't see you, my camera is not working. Like you have like obviously the people who say it's not working because they're shy or whatever. Nothing wrong with that, but I mean like it's like is that like 640 by 320 or yeah,
Yeah, the
it's
hardware is
insane.
just better, right? And now the ARM64 chips, your laptop doesn't make any noise anymore. You just close it, you put it in your bag.
Doesn't become hot anymore as well.
Exactly. Like I would wait sometimes at the older Macs. You're still blowing,
Yeah.
Now I just can't put it in the bag.
Oh yeah.
And then although the last MacBook I have, it looks much more like my 10-year-old MacBook than all the previous ones because it's thicker again. It has, but it ha then the benefit is that you have again an HDMI port. But then
Yeah.
people were like, "Oh, I don't have the escape key. Like now I need to buy another laptop." For us it was almost never the case because okay, yeah, I don't have the escape key. Too bad.
Unless you're using
It's still a better
Vim.
product. I would always use an external keyboard anyways, only on the road.
Yeah, true.
So
True.
I thinking about it, all these years that I didn't have escape key. Okay, now I have escape key. Okay. It's still so much
Yeah,
better
definitely.
product. And it survives, like the times that you bumped into something. And also the case is strong, like there's all these other laptops, like okay, I'm sure there's premium laptops also around there.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm going to mention. Like, I have some Windows machines here in the house for the kids and stuff because they use it at school, and they come a long way. But let me put it that way. Like, I mean, in the operating system, and now it's like the security by default as well. There's like malware stuff in the OS integrated. You don't have to buy a Norton subscription anymore and stuff like that, like BitLocker to lock the computer itself, to encrypt the disk and stuff. So they made some progress there as well, but nevertheless, it's still different.
You just take your AirPods and then you listen to something on your phone and then switches to your laptop. I mean, there's all these things that once, if you want to be efficient, you don't want to spend half a day trying to fix something that doesn't work, that often is not when you have non-integrated products. I mean, of course, it's more expensive and all this kind of stuff. And I'm sure, and actually now that if they're going to, like the last thing I saw, if they're going to integrate OpenAI with Apple in the operating system, and I'm like, maybe not there.
Elon Musk is banning every Apple device.
Maybe in a couple of weeks, we're like, oh, we're switching to Linux section.
exactly. Like, nope, not going to do that.
Last thing I will say, before we had a MacBook, what did we have? I had a Linux machine, a Linux machine.
Yeah. A Dell XPS or something like that, I think was called. Yeah.
The company as well, lots of people were running stuff on Linux machines as well, laptop on Linux. That was the alternative to Mac 11 years ago, something like that. I mean, of course, you could run Windows and all that kind of stuff, and I would run Windows in VMware because I needed it.
Well, or dual boot.
But...
For gaming and stuff like that, it's still...
In the last 10 years, if you just want to be efficient, coding, like, this is kind of the way to go.
Yeah. It became the go-to developer machine at some point. Probably the SF startup scene has done something to do with it, but also like all those tools get developed on the same machine as well, so kind of makes sense to stay in the same ecosystem. I think we can wrap up here unless you want to say something else.
No, I'm good.
Okay, then I think we're going to wrap up here. We'll definitely probably miss some tooling. Let us know if we missed something that we definitely should have discussed, and we can definitely make a part two of this episode as well. Thanks for tuning in.
Like all the command line tools.
exactly. All the command. Yeah, true.
What are you actually entering on the command line? Like
CD. Stuff like that. No, definitely no. I know what you mean. We'll see.
Just as an anecdote, people are always like, that can never escape a network. Like, you could never escape network in enterprise and all that stuff, or like the servers are closed. And there's always like, oh yeah, but I do this SSH tunnel from here and there. And it's...
So I can get to listen to Spotify over like I can SSH out of here through the DNS port.
I mean, I haven't done that in a long time, but I remember like there was always like a way to kind of get out of network using some tooling on the command line that you had because.
Yeah, the SSH tunnels was a very...
SSH tunnels over port 443 and stuff like that. Like, you had a server somewhere that had SSH on 443 because it would be the open port encrypted.
So you could skip hotel Wi-Fi captchas and stuff. When it used to cost money. But
That still costs money, hotel Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
Well, some hotels, I think. I'm not sure, actually.
Yeah,
But you use not now. Everyone uses 4G, so nobody even knows that Wi-Fi anymore.
No, they have to try to make get back their investment somehow. All right, Edward, it's been a blast. I will see you soon.
Yes.
Thanks everybody for tuning in. Let us know if you missed something.
Yeah, next week we'll episode because soon. I have a holiday next week.
Yeah, and I had one the previous
week. No episode last week.
So we should have announced that.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter anymore, but nevertheless. All right. See ya. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.